Good evening, and thank you for joining E-Trade's third quarter 2014 earnings conference call. Joining the call today are Chief Executive Officer Paul Itzik and Chief Financial Officer Matthew Audette. Today's call may include forward-looking statements which reflect management's current estimates or beliefs and are subject to risks and uncertainties that may cause actual results to differ materially. During the call, the company may also discuss non-GAAP financial measures. For a reconciliation of such non-GAAP measures to the comparable GAAP figures, and for a discussion of additional risks and uncertainties that may affect the future results of E-Trade Financial, please refer to our earnings release furnished with Form 8K and our 10Ks, 10Qs, and other documents the company has filed with the SEC. All of these documents are available at about.etrade.com. This call will present information as of October 21st, 2014. The company disclaims any duty to update forward-looking statements made during the call. This call is being recorded, and a replay will be available via phone and webcast later this evening at about.etrade.com. No other recordings or copies of this call are authorized or may be relied upon. With that, I will now turn the call over to Mr. Itzik.
Thank you, David. Good evening. I'd like to thank all of you for joining us again this quarter. We posted solid results for Q3 2014 and continue to make progress internally, further strengthening our business across all frames. During what is typically a seasonally slow period, trading held steady and margin balances reached record highs. Meanwhile, we enhanced the value of our franchise in terms of accounts and assets as we are seeing the early benefits from our investments in the business, including our new marketing approach. As a result of the team's continued efforts in executing on our capital plan, we made our fifth consecutive quarterly distribution from the bank to the parent this past quarter, bringing us to $400 million in cumulative dividends since Q3 of 2013. Given this, we are now in a strong place to put this capital to work. Our first area of focus is on debt reduction, where we anticipate taking action soon. We will, of course, keep you updated on this topic, but I am quite proud of what we've accomplished to bring us to this position. With respect to the firm's overall risk profile, enterprise risk management continues to have an increasingly important seat at the table as it has become so deeply ingrained in the operating culture of my colleagues that it's now an area of real strength and pride for the firm. Likewise, we continue to evolve to a greatly simplified and improved balance sheet composition. To that end, and specific to credit risk, our legacy loan portfolio continued its well-directed march downwards, declining by $350 million to end the quarter at $6.7 billion. If John Philip Sousa were still alive, he would have found it irresistible to pen the ETFC balance sheet march. Next, with respect to our focus, we continue to invest in our business to enhance the customer experience and strengthen our foundation, seeing meaningful strides on both fronts during the quarter, all with the elevated rigor, testing, and control that is the cadence of the team. In terms of enhancing the customer experience, we remain focused on digital channels and made a number of improvements to our product offering during the quarter. In mobile, we launched our new app simultaneously with the launch of iOS 8, with first-to-market functionality relative to peers, and also launched an app for the Amazon Fire Phone. On the website, to pick from a long list, we revamped our bond resource center with updated tools and solutions and are in the process of deploying a new navigation framework for customers. We also made a number of enhancements and added new functionality to our active trader platform, most prominently our more fulsome integration of FX trading. And finally, as we evolve our offering suite to meet customers increasingly on their own terms, we launched a browser-based trading solution, enabling real-time monitoring and execution while investors are traveling outside the walls of our own digital properties. As we introduce these front-of-house enhancements, we are simultaneously investing in stronger technology capabilities and more efficient operating procedures to ensure we are maintaining E-Trade as a robust home for our customers' financial matters. Turning to our financial results, we recorded earnings of 29 cents for the quarter on net income of $86 million. Earnings included an income tax benefit of around 3 cents, provision expense at the bottom of our expected range, and a sequentially flat net interest spread due largely to a robust performance in margin receivables and securities lending. Now, in terms of brokerage metrics, trading activity was solid in what is typically a seasonally slow period, as DARTs of 153,000 were down just 1% from the prior quarter and up 6% from the prior year. October is continuing this trend, with month-to-date trade ups another 12% from September, as volatility has picked up significantly over the past several weeks. Options represented 23% of our Q3 trades, generally consistent with where they've been over the past couple of years. Our mobile platforms remain a celebrated and important part of our offering, as mobile DARTs represented more than 11% of our total this quarter, continuing the trend of increased adoption and nicely above the 8% we saw for all of last year. Customer margin receivables reached new highs during the quarter, with average balances increasing $300 million to $7.6 billion and exiting the quarter at $8.1 billion. We continue to see some yield compression as margin utilization again shifted towards higher balance accounts. We also continued our solid account and asset growth with year-to-date net new brokerage accounts of 128,000, already eclipsing full-year totals for each of the past 5 years. We added 24,000 net new brokerage accounts in the quarter, down from 33,000 in the prior quarter, as our attrition rate ticked up slightly to 9.1%, consistent with seasonal trends seen in Q3. Year-to-date, our attrition rate is a solid 8.5%. Net new brokerage assets were a healthy $2.3 billion in the quarter, up from $1 billion in the prior quarter, which reflected seasonality around tax time in April. Within customer assets, we ended Q3 with nearly $3 billion of managed assets, up about $1 billion from a year ago. These fee-based products continue to be an area of focus for us as we work to do more for our customers in response to their needs and to diversify our revenue streams. Our corporate services business continues to prove strategically important as a steady generator of roughly a third of our gross new accounts. We are committed to providing a best-in-class offering for employers and their plan participants. And we're quite gratified to receive external validation for our hard work with a number one rating for client satisfaction and loyalty by Group 5 in their annual stock plan administration study, the largest of its kind and considered a respected authority for the stock plan industry. This is the third consecutive year our platform, Equity Edge Online, has won this distinction. As we canter towards year-end, I'm proud of what we've accomplished and where we stand. Our resolute focus on our customers is apparent in the metrics, and we remain dedicated to executing on our plans to invest in and grow the business in an incisive and deliberate manner. Our regulatory dialogue is one with which we are quite pleased and which will continue to get the thoughtful attention it deserves. Further, our unwavering commitment to reducing risk is quite visibly paying dividends. And with that, I will turn our call over to our pertinacious CFO, Matthew Audette.
Thank you, Mr. Idzik. From my standpoint, this was an outstanding quarter for us, and another one of clear progress in terms of improving our risk profile, honing our focus on the core business, and demonstrating solid execution toward our capital goals, achieving an additional dividend from the bank, and positioning us to take actions on our corporate debt when the time is right. So to start with our results, we reported third quarter net income of $86 million, or 29 cents per share, up from net income of $69 million, or 24 cents per share in Q2, and net income of $47 million, or 16 cents per share in the year-ago quarter. Our results benefited from an effective tax rate of 31% this quarter. This was a result of an $8 million, or 3 cent benefit, that primarily related to the settlement of a state tax audit. Absent this benefit, our tax rate would have been 38%. Net revenues of $440 million were up from $438 million in the prior quarter, and $417 million in the year-ago quarter. Revenue included net interest income of $269 million, essentially flat with the prior quarter, as both net interest spread and our average assets were relatively unchanged. Our spread remained elevated in Q3 and declined just one basis point as the benefit from the performance of margin and stock loan offset the impact of higher prepayment speeds on the securities portfolio, and reduced yield on the loan portfolio, which had a one-time benefit in Q2 related to the sale of modified loans. With respect to our spread going forward, the biggest drivers of near-term fluctuations will again be margin and stock loan. So if we hold those levels constant from where we ended Q3, our spread next quarter would be in the low to mid 250s. One additional point on the interest rate environment. Last week, we saw some of the most remarkable volatility in interest rates since the crisis. While rates have largely recovered from the lows last week, if those low rates return, our spread would be biased downward going forward. Given how much our spread is being driven by margin and stock loan, combined with our philosophy of taking minimal interest rate risk, I would not expect this downward pressure to be meaningful, especially in the near term. But I think it's important to highlight that if interest rates move at the extremes we saw last week and remain there, we would certainly be impacted. Our balance sheet ended the quarter at $45.8 billion, flat with the prior quarter as customer cash decreased, while wholesale funding ticked up slightly by $175 million. This increase in wholesale funding related to large amounts of customer activity near quarter end, and we expect this to roll off next quarter. Commissions, fees and service charges, and other revenue in the third quarter were $163 million, up slightly from the prior quarter and up 7% from the year-ago quarter. Average commission per trade of $11.05 increased 33 cents from the prior quarter, but was down 10 cents from the year-ago period. The sequential increase was primarily driven by options trade. Fees and service charges revenues of $45 million included $22 million of payment for order flow, flat with the prior quarter. Net gains on loans and securities were $8 million this quarter, up slightly from $7 million in Q2, which primarily related to the sale of TDRs. Our operating expenses for the quarter were $277 million, down from $284 million in the prior quarter. Marketing expense was the primary driver of the decline as we pulled back our spending during the summer. This was partially offset by an increase in compensation, which reflects the impact of hiring in the first half of the year, along with higher incentive compensation. For next quarter, we expect expenses to be closer to Q2 levels, which includes a sequential increase in marketing, in line with our expectations for a full-year increase of 10%. And compensation will be biased downward from Q3, as it contained the impact of some severance and incentive comp. The loan portfolio ended the quarter at $6.7 billion, down $350 million from the prior quarter. Paydowns were again the driver, as charge-offs were minimal at just $10 million. We expect quarterly runoff in the range of 4 to 5% over the next few quarters. Provision for loan losses was also $10 million, down from $12 million in the previous quarter and at the bottom of our expected range. Our allowance for loan losses ended the quarter at $401 million, unchanged from the prior quarter. While the total balance was stable, the allocations continue to shift to home equity portfolio, which will continue to drive the majority of credit costs. Meanwhile, the overall health of the portfolio continued to improve, as the average CLTV for the home equity portfolio improved to 92% from 94%, and the average LTV for the 1-to-4 family portfolio improved to 79% from 81% in the prior quarter. Over the past few years, we've seen a significant increase in home prices, which has been a meaningful tailwind to the performance of our portfolio, with the most dramatic improvements to the performance of the 1-to-4 book. And while the home equity book has also been a clear beneficiary of this trend, the vast majority of those loans, at slightly over $2 billion, are HELOCs which have yet to reach their amortization period, a credit event which we expect will drive increased losses. Our home equity provision was $29 million this quarter, which included additional reserves related to a planned loan transfer from a servicer that is exiting the third-party home equity servicing business. While we have conducted many transfers in the past, this one is unique for us as it relates exclusively to home equity loans, which can prove more challenging when transferred. Excluding that charge, home equity provision would have been just above $20 million, which is consistent with the previous quarter and broadly in line with our expectations for next quarter. Meanwhile, the 1-to-4 family portfolio reserve declined by $17 million related to lower loss severities. While we now have an allowance of $27 million against these loans, leaving very little room to continue reducing this balance. Now, with the vast majority of remaining risk being in the home equity portfolio, we expect future provision expense to be concentrated in that category. So while we continue to feel comfortable with the diminishing level of risk in the overall portfolio, we do expect provision to migrate up over the next 2 years as we navigate through the vast majority of our HELOCs entering their amortization period, with expectations to trend towards the higher end of our $10 to $30 million quarterly range. As a reminder, losses associated with HELOCs converting to amortizing payments are incredibly difficult to predict. However, with each quarter that passes, we're able to gather more information on the actual performance of these loans, giving us the ability to apply an increasing level of precision over time. Turning now to capital. Over the near term, we continue to focus squarely on debt reduction as a first order of business. As we discussed last quarter, based on our current thinking and analysis, we believe $1 billion is the right amount of debt for us over the long term. Through the capital flexibility we've achieved, we've been able to upstream $400 million in dividends to the parent over the past five quarters. This has brought our parent cash levels above $600 million. Given our desire to maintain at least 2 years of debt service coverage, which is $220 million today, we believe we are in a position to reduce our debt in the near term by approximately $400 million. It has been a long road to get to this position, and I am incredibly excited to be working through the plans and tactics to reduce our debt. As we work to finalize our plans, we are focused on a few things. First, addressing what is most economical. Second, improving our maturity profile. And finally, remaining mindful of the current and forecasted rate environment for refinance transactions. Again, we are working on our plans and hope to finalize them soon. One final point on the capital plan. Our objective remains to manage to a lower bank Tier 1 leverage ratio of 9% by year end, with continued annual reductions to a target of 8% in 2016. While we cannot predict the timing or likelihood of the regulatory approval required to do so, it is our objective and we are focused on it. We hope to have more to share with you by our next earnings call on this topic. And with that, operator, we'll open the call for questions.
Thank you, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone keypad. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. And lastly, if you're using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before entering your request. Our first question comes from the line of Patrick O'Shaughnessy with Raymond James. Your line is open.
Hey, good afternoon, guys.
Hello, Patrick.
So the first question I have is, you've been seeing some really nice acceleration of your net new account growth, but your net new asset growth is actually lagging behind that a little bit. And it looks to me that 2014 is on pace to be your slowest year for net new asset growth since probably around 2008. So I was curious if you can explain kind of what leads to that lag between the really strong net new account growth and the slower net new asset growth, and then probably more importantly, talk about what you think you can do to accelerate that net new asset growth from here.
Well, Patrick, I'd be careful not to draw any conclusions and draw a trend line from one quarter. Part of what contributed to that difference in ratio, if you will, if you think about it as a ratio, was ETCS had a slightly lower quarter as a result of some variety of actions with some of our larger clients. And since a third of our net new accounts come from ETCS, that has an impact on our numbers. But what I'm excited by is not only the growth in accounts, again, doing a fantastic job year to date relative to full years in prior periods, and getting those accounts in, and then we're also demonstrating how well we're gathering greater shares of their wallet. I think we're getting the job done quite well. I didn't hear the second part of your question, Patrick. You broke up a bit.
Yeah, sorry. So the question was, so you've seen the really nice growth rate in your new accounts, but the growth rate in the net new assets has been lagging that a little bit. So I'm just curious, is there a reason why the net new asset growth rate has been a little bit slower, and kind of what specifically you think you can do to try to reaccelerate that a little bit?
Well, in the second part, in terms of reaccelerating, again, we looked carefully at the quarter and understand the impact of some perturbations caused by changes in what happened within the corporate sector of ETCS. But the change in approach to marketing to be not only focused more on prospects and their unique requirements, but spending much more time understanding existing customer needs and marketing and making ourselves available to existing customers is demonstrated in increased wallet share. So we feel good about migrating those net new accounts to larger and larger relationships over time, again, on our customers' own terms. Does that get your question answered?
Yes, thank you. And then my follow-up question would be probably for Matt. So you talked about the growth in the sec lending business as being a big driver for the net interest spread kind of coming in where it did. Is there something structurally changed at this point with security lending that this is kind of the new run rate? Because it's not just you guys. It's Schwab. Ameritrade's had strength of this too. Is there something going on that has just made this a sustainably better business for you?
Well, Patrick, I think a couple of things. One, keep in mind the stock lending business in general is going to trend with the margin lending business, right? So the more margin you have, the more stock there is to loan out. So I think as margin has grown, there's more stock loan to be had. The nature of the stock loan business is definitely going to be more volatile from an earnings standpoint, right? When there are certain stocks that are hard to borrow, you earn a lot on those stocks, and that can go away in an instant. So I think the nature of the business is a little bit more volatile, but to answer the question, no, that I don't think there's anything structurally. I just think it points to one of the many different revenue streams that really comes from our business, right? It's not just commissions. It's interest, which includes margin. It's stock loan. There's fee income. There's a lot of different things, and I think we're just highlighting one that's performing quite well right now.
Gotcha. Appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Hey, Patrick, I have one for you.
Yes, sir.
What did you think of the call last weekend?
I think that it was not pass interference.
You're a good man, Patrick. Next question.
Our next question comes from the line of Chris Allen with Evercore. Your line is open.
Afternoon, guys.
Hey, Chris.
Just wanted to follow up, I guess, quickly on the set borrowed stock lending topic. I mean, judging by the color you've given in terms of looking at into 4Q so far, fair to say that obviously, the margin balance is end of the period at a high level. The stock lending business continued at a fairly high level, even with the volatility we've had so far to start the quarter.
Well, I'd just say directionally on margin and stock loan, they have pulled back a bit, not dramatically, pulled back a bit into October.
Got it. Okay. And then just on compensation. I was wondering if you could give us any color in terms of the impact of incentive comp this quarter and on severance. And it looks like you guys continue hiring through 3Q. So I'm just wondering kind of is the full run rate of the hiring you've done this year into the compensation numbers going forward?
Yeah, so the incentive comp, so just looking at the sequential increase quarter over quarter, the incentive comp was the biggest driver of that. And we reached some, as the financial results have been quite good this year, we hit some performance thresholds during the quarter. So you've got 9 months worth of that incentive compensation in the third quarter. So that's the primary reason why I would expect it to be biased down next quarter. That was a big driver. I think the hires that we made, if you look at just the pure headcount in the first half of the year, especially in the second quarter, a lot of that hiring was done in the month of June or at the end of the quarter. So that was a big reason for the increase in Q3. I don't see that same effect in a big way in the third quarter. So I think it's really the incentive compensation and the severance that we certainly are not sitting here today having any of that assumed into Q4. That happens when it happens. So the incentive accruals are going to be the big drivers going forward.
Got it. Thanks. We'll get back in the queue.
And our next question comes from the line of Alex Blostein with Goldman Sachs. And your line is open.
Great. Hey, good afternoon, guys.
Hey, Alex.
So I was hoping to spend a little bit of time on the HELOCs. I guess, Matt, if you guys could provide a little more granularity on the resets as we approach 2015. Obviously, we know the amount that's resetting, but any sense of what's the minimum payment today versus what it's going to be versus kind of what people are paying today, just to kind of give us a sense of the actual net shock to the sort of the monthly payments?
Sure, Alex. So not much has changed there, right? I can give you directional comments, right? The absolute size of these loans are relatively small, numbers you probably know, roughly $75,000 per loan. So they're just the total payments they're making today are relatively small. So the payment increases we're talking about are a few hundred dollars a month, right? It's not dramatic. It's dramatic, of course, if you can't afford $300 or a few hundred dollars a month, but it's relatively small. I think what we've seen so far on the ones that have converted is consistent with what we've said the past couple quarters, which is the population is still relatively small. Another 3 months have gone by. We like what we see in the category. There's not a big dramatic credit event here, but it's a small population. So we ground ourselves in that. But that's what we've seen so far.
Got it. And then from staying in the HELOCs for a second, and the prepayments that we've seen obviously continuously going up, you know, in dollar terms and obviously in the percentage terms as well. Is there a wide kind of distribution between the years where these HELOCs are amortizing and what they're prepaying, or do you think it's kind of evenly spread? So, you know, if somebody is starting to amortize in 15 versus somebody who's amortizing in 16, there's not a huge divergence in what the excess payment these people are making right now.
Yeah, there's no dramatic difference, Alex. I mean, I think that the primary point there is there are people are making voluntary prepayments, whether they're refinancing out or they're just making small curtailments. The balances continue to get smaller. The biggest bucket remains in 2016 at around $1 billion, but there's nothing to infer about, you know, as we get closer to it, that the voluntary payments are spiking in a big way in 2015. There's nothing dramatic to highlight there. I just think the broad point that they continue to pay down is the important one.
All right. Thanks.
Yep.
And our next question comes from a line of Rich Repetto with Sandler O'Neill. Your line is open.
Yeah, hi. My question first is for Matt, the pertinacious guy that he is. The NIM, the funding rate on the FHLB advances dropped by 49 bips. Just trying to see, I don't think you made it, spoke to that in the prepared comments. Was there anything going on there when balances were pretty much the same?
Yeah, Rich. Yeah, I did not address that in the prepared comments. It's a good question. So a lot of the wholesale funding is a mix of both the FHLB advances and the in the repos, or a mix of wholesale funding combined with hedges, a lot of which we have terminated. So there's a lot of expense amortizing against those, and there's just simply an old hedge where it reached its amortization term and that rolled off, meaning you would expect to see a similar rate on that line going forward.
Okay. And then just one follow-up on the home equity guidance that you've given. So if things didn't meaningfully change or change, are we just getting out of some precision on, you know, are we just being conservative when we're guiding to sort of towards the high end of the provision because of the amortization?
Yeah, Rich. So I think in keep in mind, I'm given our overall views over the next couple of years. So where we sit today, right? The home equity provision has been pretty consistent in the $20 million roughly a quarter range, and that's how we see it in the near term. We just want to make sure that we highlight as we actually get into the meat, into the heart of these amortizations in 2015 and 16. Everything else being equal, you would think it would migrate up from where it is now, right? So that starts to put us into the higher end of the range on the home equity side. And then you add to that that the reserves on the 1-4 side are now down to such a small balance that natural offset that we've seen to the past couple quarters that's landed provision down in the $10 million-ish range, that's not going to be there. So it's really just highlighting that. There's no, you know, new information that we're really using to highlight that. I think it's just really highlighting the natural trends that we've seen over the last couple quarters and how they would play out over the next couple years.
Okay. And then one last thing for Paul. It seems like what's going around the industry is there's a lot of talk about these online advisory firms, the robo-advisors, as they refer to them. And, you know, when you look at what you're trying to do, Paul, you know, grow, sort of change the complexion of the P&L, more fee-based with managed accounts, and you know, focus on, you know, the new branding on Type B and digital, you know, people that are very comfortable dealing in a digital world, it would seem like a, you know, a perfect blend in your strategy. So I was just trying to see, you know, have you looked at this? You know, what are the plans? Is it a build or a buy if you do think it's, you know, something you'll get into as far as online advice?
Thanks, Rich. While the term robo-advisor has been relatively new and certainly received significant airtime lately, it's actually something that's been core to our offering for quite some time. Our model, as you know, is focused on empowering self-directed investors and traders through digital technology and supported by professional advice when they seek it, our education tools and guidance. So we've always been focused on online tools that deliver advice, help customers determine allocations, help them make better decisions. And we've had an online advisor tool for quite some time that is quite part of our offering to customers and is completely free to use. So
these type of tools are part of our DNA. It's something we continue to refine every day as we go to deliver for our customers. Our tool works across investing styles and doesn't try and direct someone to a particularly pre-canned idea of what's right for them. And the true self-directed investor can get a truly customized portfolio, mapping to their needs for as little as the cost of placing the trades, which is to put themselves in position with the portfolio. So we feel that we've been in this business for a while, and I guess my regret is I didn't coin the phrase robo-advisor and charge a penny for every time it appears in print.
You'd get a higher valuation if you did for that tool. Anyway, that's all I had. Thanks.
Thanks, Rich.
Our next question comes from the line of Steven Chubak with Nomura. Your line is open.
Hi, good evening. So the first question I had actually relates to yield curve expectations. There appears to be a growing consensus among many of the market participants that we speak with that if and when the Fed begins to hike rates, that we could actually experience more of a flattening yield curve versus a parallel shift. And I was hoping you could maybe just speak to how we should think about that potential earnings impact if that scenario plays out, with, of course, the all-important caveat that the evolving composition of your balance sheet could certainly alter the future forecasting there.
Sure. So I think our views on the long-term spread potential of our balance sheet at 300 basis points have been our views for quite some time. And I think the thing to keep in mind in that commentary is where we make our money. We make our money on the deposit side, right? So raising money cheaper than it would cost us to go borrow it. We're not making our money on taking interest rate risk and moving out the curve. So I think I feel comfortable where we're headed on the interest rate side and getting those 300 basis points. You know, as a general statement, right, the flatter the yield curve, you know, the harder it is to make money, right? There's no getting around that. But we don't get caught up in the short-term movements or speculation on where the curve's going to go. We know we've got a great business model that will generate a lot of net interest income today and more as rates go up. So we just keep focused on running the business.
Hey, thanks. And I just have one follow-up relating to the provision guidance. Matt, it sounded as though you believe that it's going to stay at the higher end of the range for the next couple of years. And I suppose where I'm struggling a little bit is trying to reconcile that guidance, which seems overly conservative in the context of where your reserves are today and the loss experience that you've had, and relative to even with the net charge-off or the step-up in charge-offs that you could experience, given that your loss coverage is so elevated. I suppose I'm just trying to understand exactly how to think about the allowance for loan loss reserves and that trajectory, even with the step-up in the provision, given that you've already been preparing for this for such a long time.
Yeah, so I'd say a couple things. First and foremost, a lot of the guidance starts with when you look at the 1-4 family reserves, right? We are down to $27 million, right? I don't think it's a stretch to say that and just using this quarter as an example, right? Provision was reduced $16 million simply from the 1-4 family bucket, right? That is, we are at the near end of that continuing. So then you move over to, okay, what is a reasonable estimate of where home equity is going? Right, we're sitting here at the third quarter of 2014. The vast majority of amortizations are ahead of us, right? They're not behind us, they're ahead of us. So I think the natural assumption that number would be biased up slightly is a fair one. But I think the caveat that I would have, that I had in the prepared remarks and I would have now, is this stuff is incredibly difficult to predict. So, you know, I'm answering a very specific question, but this stuff is hard to predict, right? We've never had the scenario we're having right now, where loans are going to hit the amortization period and have gone through a period of declining home prices for so long, even though they've recovered significantly recently. No one's ever gone through this before. With all that being said, I think it's reasonable to assume that provision would go up slightly, that the 1-4 family releases are going to stop, and that's what gets us to thinking we'll be at the higher end of the range. Keep in mind I'm talking about over the next 2 years, right? I'm not talking about next quarter, right? Next quarter we're biased to a level closer to where we were this quarter, but again, biased up a little bit because of that 1-4 family issue. So hopefully that gives you context to our thinking.
No, that's really helpful. All right, thank you for taking my questions.
Our next question comes from the line of Mike Carrier with Bank of America.
Thanks, guys. Hey, Matt, just on the net interest spread outlook, so you gave some color on the fourth quarter. Just when you're thinking about 2015, assuming that the margin balances, holding this level, securities lending, can continue, just based on, where the rate outlook is and, maybe keep it at a, 250 10-year, but then just the roll-off of the loan portfolio, are you still thinking like a 240, range for next year, or has that shifted?
Yeah, so Mike, so we'll give 2015 views and guidance on the next call. I mean, I think the thing to keep in mind is just the at the margin levels and stock loan earnings levels that we're at right now, those are really big drivers. Just especially looking at the last couple quarters, right? The movement in that has meaningfully moved spread from what we expected, just given those moves. So we'll have 15 our thoughts on 15 next quarter. For now, I've just got what I said about Q4.
Okay, and then just as a follow-up, so in terms of the capital deployment, you guys have been real clear on the debt pay down. I guess longer term, if you think that there is more opportunity to move some of those deposits back on balance sheet, like what are the hurdles in terms of getting past that $50 billion? Like in terms of whether it's cost systems, just what would it take for you guys to do 2 to 3 years out, to get there?
We talked about this at the last call, and it turned into an analyst's feeding frenzy and dog's breakfast. So Matt's been pretty clear about our priorities in the near term. Number one is taking a bite out of our debt load. And as we start to reassess our priorities, we'll be happy to start communicating to those to you guys when we get there. But I'm not entering into this debate again because you guys went in a bit of a feeding frenzy with not a lot of content last time. So that's it on this topic.
Our next question comes from the line of Devin Ryan with JMP Securities.
Okay, thanks. Well, that just took one of my questions off the table.
I'm happy about that.
Devin, don't ask about 50, buddy. Don't do it.
I won't. But just a quick follow-up here maybe on the net interest spread question. So, cash flow hedges have obviously limited, I think, some of your downside from falling rates in recent years. And so just trying to understand that dynamic a little bit better and how you guys use the interest rate hedges. And are they constantly rolling on and off, or is there more of a maturity schedule there? So we could maybe think about there's some point in the future where you lose some of the benefit. Just trying to think about the dynamic since you guys are very dynamic around managing your balance sheet.
Yeah, so the interest rate risk philosophy, Devin, hasn't changed. Which is we look to run at minimal levels of interest rate risk. Now, the balance sheet content we had in the past, right, the place that we chose to put those interest rate derivatives and manage that risk, a lot of that was on the wholesale book. So you see that specifically rolling off in those line items, but that hasn't changed our interest rate risk philosophy, right? So we continue to focus on minimal risk. You can do that in a bunch of different ways, and the types of securities that you buy, the duration of the securities that you buy. So there's lots of different ways to do that, and that hasn't changed.
Got it. Okay, great. And then just maybe lastly, with respect to data tracking, and you guys seem to be very data-driven, at least since Paul and Naptej joined. Just around some of the metrics that are important, whether it be funding rates. I mean, can you give any update on progress on funding rates? I think you're up to 58%, at least last time we spoke, from 50%. I mean, where some of the kind of important data on the brokerage side, can you give any update on where those metrics are trending?
Yeah, Devin,
we're looking for that data. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think nothing to add there, Devin. I think the metric you're referring to is the increased funding rate on our new online application. I think we're still pleased with that. I don't think we have an update on what that data is today, but we're happy with the performance. It's one of the things driving the new account metrics that we talked through, the new asset metrics we talked through, but we don't have a specific update on that.
Okay.
We'll try Devin, that's a really good question. We'll try and bring some of that next quarter. That's a very solid question. And the reason I'm struggling is we were looking at that earlier today, and for some reason we just don't have those numbers at hand right now. But we'll make sure we cover that next update.
Okay. Thanks, Jonathan.
Our next question comes from the line of Joel Jeffrey with KBW.
Hey, good evening, guys.
Hey, Joel.
I mean, most of my questions were asked and answered. Just a quick one, though. Can you talk a little bit about how the sort of typical activity of one of your mobile clients might compare to a more sort of average client? And it does look like the darts coming from mobile was pretty consistent with last quarter, but I think we've heard from some of your competitors that they tend to be a bit more active.
I'd say, first of all, we're pleased with the engagement we have with so many of our customers across multiple platforms. And it's one of the reasons why we're not just investing in one place in which we reach our customers, but all of them, including our branches and our call centers. But to answer your question, our individuals, our clients who use our mobile app to trade tend to be a bit better healed. They trade more often, and they're amongst our most engaged customers in terms of using the full spread and depth of our capabilities and what we offer at E-Trade. So we're quite excited when we start to see people use our mobile apps to a fuller extent because they tend to turn out to be better customers over time.
But there's nothing you could give us to say that they potentially trade, you know, one more time a month or anything along those lines.
I don't think that's not something we would typically share.
Great. Thanks for taking my questions.
Our next question comes from the line of Kenneth Hill with Barclays. The line's open.
Hi. Hey. Good afternoon, everyone. Just had a quick question on the advisor franchise there. So you've got about, I think, a little bit over 300 financial advisors. I'm wondering if you're seeing a little bit more demand in the current environment right now and if you have any plans to really step that up, particularly if we enter a more volatile environment here.
Yeah, we've been working quite hard to improve the tools and training of our financial advisors, as well as the type of branch atmosphere we'd like across the country. Our intent is to not only continue to invest in the tools to support our financial advisors so they can support our customers better, but we are in the process of trying to add well-skilled, client-focused advisors and hope to be reporting higher numbers of advisors over the next several quarters.
Okay. The other question I had, I guess, in the current environment, we tend to hear a lot about cybersecurity and a lot of attacks and even potential breaches on data. Wondering if you could speak to how that's impacted your business and maybe what activities you guys are taking and also potentially, I guess, any additional costs you might see longer term because of increased scrutiny around that area.
Yeah, while we don't break out our expenses in that level of granularity, I think it's safe to say we are spending more both in terms of hardware, software, and highly skilled technology engineers to keep track of what's happening 24/7 in our environment. We're increasingly and to a level of paranoia around cybersecurity. Protecting our customers' personal and account information is our top priority, and we are continuously investing in this area. Additionally, I think it's important we work with government institutions and also collaborate with others in the financial services industry to share information so that we can continue to keep our skill set sharp. It's a never-ending battle out there on this front, and just can't let our guard down. And our customers expect us to stay sharp on this, and we are indeed trying to do so.
Okay. Thanks for taking my questions.
Our next question comes from Dan Fannin with Jefferies.
Thanks. Just one for me, I guess. In terms of your balance sheet and the debt, I guess, how would you characterize, you know, the debt markets today for potential refinancings for E-Trade?
Well, Dan, they're incredibly volatile, especially on the high yield market where we would issue. You know, if you just go back, you know, week and a half ago, things got so volatile. There were very few people doing anything. If you went to the few weeks prior to that, the markets were incredibly good. And if you're sitting here today, they've absolutely firmed up a bit. So hopefully you take from those comments that we monitor them closely. And I think we'd be in a position whenever it made sense to make a judgment on when it made sense to do something versus not.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
And our next question comes from the line of Chris Harris with Wells Fargo. Your line is open.
Thanks. A couple quick ones on the expenses. Matt, you talked about, you know, the downside risk to NIM if, you know, rates really stay depressed for a while. Just wondering, you know, what kind of flexibility you guys might have on the expense side of the ledger. I know you, you know, recently upped the expenses a little bit to invest for growth. Could any of that be on the table if we had, you know, really low rates for a long while, or might you not want to sacrifice growth just for the sake of, you know, offsetting pressure on the NIM?
We'd absolutely look at our expense position if we had a prolonged period of slowdown. We're pretty happy with how we're investing, both in terms of where and our approach to it. And let me give an example. We've done a pretty thorough job of trying to make as much of our investment profile not only subject to some pretty rigorous screens inside, but as bite-sized as possible, so that it's more flexible and more able to be steered one way or the other in the future. At the same time, you can appreciate that once you've started a project, one of the toughest things to do is stop it midstream, because the shareholders really don't benefit from that initial spend if it's a well-purposed, business-oriented, customer-facing, or regulatory topic. So we're staying on top of it, and of course we have some flexibility, and we'll continue to monitor it in the future. But again, as I said on a different topic, we want to make sure we don't overly respond to a swing one quarter one way or the other.
That makes perfect sense, and I'm sure you guys said it and I missed the number. What's the operating expense guidance for next quarter?
So closer to the Q2 levels, right? So low to mid-280s.
Okay, thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, as a brief reminder, to register for a question, it is the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone keypad. Our next question comes from the line of Brian Bedell with Deutsche Bank.
Hi, good evening, folks.
Hey, Brian.
Just a quick question for Matt and then another follow-up. Just on the NIM outlook again for the fourth quarter, I just was unclear of whether that includes the current rate backdrop. And then I think you mentioned, obviously, if we got to those extreme levels, is that meaning that like that 195 10-year as the extreme levels, that would be the more material pressure on the NIM?
Yeah, so in the short term, Brian, there's the big drivers are going to be margin and stock loan, right? Even the volatility in interest rates on a individual quarter basis, right? With margin and stock loan driving such a large piece of our spread, combined with our philosophy on taking minimal interest rate risk, there wouldn't be any dramatic short term movements, right? You'd have to have a serious movement in interest rates to see that. So my comments were more that margin and stock loan are going to drive things. And if we do return to the extreme low levels of rates we saw last week for a long time, that would impact us over the long term, but not much in the short term.
Right. And just on the level of margin and stock loan that's implied in your fourth quarter guidance, is that more of the trend that you're seeing now in October, or more of the third quarter levels?
Yeah, no, more third quarter. I'm giving you more comments on where if we held where we exited Q3. That's what Q4 would look like.
Got it. Okay. And then just on the capital, as opposed to the questions on the use of the capital, just more about the plan with the Fed in terms of stepping down to the 9 and the 8.5 and the 8.0. I guess how should we be modeling this over the 3-year period, or should we be thinking that as you have a leverage ratio that's likely going to be 10.5 or better next quarter, that, you know, we should be managing that down to 9% in terms of our expectation of dividending cash up to the parent, which would imply a good, you know, at least $300 or $400 million or more instead of the $75 million? Or should we just be thinking about this over, say, a 3-year period?
Let me try this one, Matt. We've been sending messages around this for quite some time, and the inference to you should be that we've not really changed our intentions. We in the near term we plan to continue requesting $75 million per quarter. In the meantime, we're focused on taking down our leverage ratio to our targeted 9% by year end. We feel very good about our regulatory relationships. We have active and, quite frankly, constructive dialogues with our regulators. But can't predict the timing or certainty of achieving exactly that objective of 9%, and we hope to provide more by our next earnings call, not only on the use of the capital, but how we're doing on this ratio. So I hope to let you know that we're not taking the eye off the ball on this one, and that we continue to have that as a goal for 2014.
Right. So just in getting down to that 9%, that would imply a much higher dividend than 75. Do I have that correct, or can you have both the 75 and the 9%?
That your math is absolutely correct.
Okay.
It would absolutely be much higher. But I don't know if at the last point there you're saying, do you get down to 9% and do a 75? It is, if we are successful in the objectives that Paul, I think, highlighted quite well, there would be an amount of capital much larger than 75 that would come out to get you down, right? Sitting here at our balance sheet size today at 10.4, right, that's $500 million or so to get you down to 9%, right? So it would be,
yep,
if successful, a much bigger number.
Got it. Okay, that's very clear. Thanks so much.
Sure.
And, gentlemen, there are no further questions waiting. I'll turn the presentation back to yourselves. Thank you.
So thank you very much for joining us for this quarter. We're quite proud of where we are and look forward to our continuing dialogue with each of you over a variety of public venues. Thanks very much. Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines. Thank you once again for attending. Have a nice day.